When we consider the processes by which human beings interact with the superhuman powers, it's important to set these interactions into the context of other activities in which people are engaged. In the first place, of course, we have to consider, as I've emphasised already, that the superhuman powers themselves are not a homogeneous group. It's possible that we are really dealing there with a whole set of rather different forces, and I've said something about that already. We also have to bear in mind the way in which human beings interact with other people, the fact that other people are themselves various and different. And it's also important to bear in mind a further grouping with whom people interact, and these are animals. Beyond that, of course, one should also bring into account the whole subject of interaction with plants. There are a massive set of human interactions with plants, the plants we eat, the plants we use for medication, the plants which surround us, the plants which form the habitats in which we live. In this particular series, I'm not going to place much emphasis upon plants. This is not because that's not important, it's extremely important, but it takes us too far away from the kind of interactions, that is, between people and superhumans, which are an essential part of this series. In the case of animals, however, it is vital to bring them in to the discussion, because in some human contexts, it is virtually impossible to distinguish between an animal and a superhuman being. When dealing with Amerindian peoples conspicuously, it is often virtually impossible to tell whether one is interacting with an animal as such or with a spirit of some kind. Now, when we look at the human interaction with animals which are not human, there is a problem at the very beginning, because the English language here contains some essential contradictions. Basically, in spoken English, when you're actually using the language from day to day, what is happening is that animal means quite distinctively not human. Cats, dogs, horses, sheep are not human. Animals mean not human, and indeed, on the whole, animal is a derogatory term. He behaved like an animal means he behaved very badly. He behaved in a way that is not ideally human. But there is a problem here, and it's a very serious problem, because in literary English, in the spoken language of the universities, and also in certainly printed English of any kind, animal has a meaning which includes human. Certainly ever since the mid-18th century, when Carl Linné published his Systema Naturae, human beings within the world of learned English have been themselves animals. People are human. Linné grouped people with chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans, in a type which is seen as a single, as it were, family likeness group. He did not regard people as descended from chimpanzees or gorillas. As a matter of fact, he quite explicitly rejected any theory of evolution, though he knew that one was possible. But nevertheless, he grouped them together into a single type. He saw them as members, as it were, of a single family, basically a family that he called Homo, human male, human man. Now, this is the process which we have inherited to the present time. And strictly speaking, of course, when I talk about animals, I should be saying non-human animals. I won't necessarily say non-human every time, but non-human is understood. The animals about which I am speaking, quite particularly in this lecture, are those animals which are not human. And these are a grouping with which all over the world people interact. When we look at animals from the standpoint of the English-speaking countries at the present time, we are constantly confused by the fact that these countries are industrial. A high proportion of populations live in big cities. They do not interact with other animals as much as they would as if they were living in a desert or a rainforest. But of course, by the same token, in these very societies, people's sense of animals has been sharpened by their absence. Feelings about the conservation of animals, people's feelings even about animal rights, have been enormously enhanced by living in industrial societies and in extensive urban areas. The very fact that one isn't living in the same forest with the tigers and the elephants, in a curious way, has made those tigers and those elephants far more important, far more romantically significant. However, what I want to concentrate on during today's lecture is particularly the interaction between people who don't live in industrial societies and the animals around them. And when you are presented with trying to say something significant about this particular subject, perhaps the first reaction of most people is that there are two things that can be said about the human interaction with the non-human animals. The first of these is there is such a human interaction. Human beings do register other animals, many of them as very important, emotively, symbolically, highly significant. But the other reaction, perhaps, is more or less, help, what can we say about it which is at all orderly and which is at all significant? There is perhaps a sense of being overwhelmed by the animal kingdom, or perhaps more accurately in terms of what I've been saying, a sense of being overwhelmed by the non-human face of the animal kingdom. It's difficult enough dealing with humans. When we have to deal with the non-human animals as well, it becomes simply overwhelming. It becomes bewildering. Now, happily for us, the situation is not quite as critically difficult as it may look at first blush. That second reaction does not need to overwhelm us. And what I'm hoping to do in the course of this lecture is to lay out a basic pattern with the help of some illustrations which will show you that people's reactions to other animals are not a mess. They are in fact part of a very orderly pattern. Indeed, lectures of this kind would be totally impossible if there were not some discernible pattern, not only in our relations with other animals, but with other people, and with all bodies of knowledge whatsoever. Because this lecture is necessarily brief, because I don't want to keep you listening for hour after hour, necessarily too, I will have to cut short the provision of some of the evidence. But let me emphasize again, as I have already in this series, that if you mistrust what I am saying, then you can test it. What I am saying is not the result of arcane knowledge, which is hidden away in my private library. It is based upon evidence which is widely available. Any ethnological library at random, in Oxford, in Cambridge, in London, any ethnological library contains the books which contain the information which I am drawing on. I am not claiming some special inner knowledge which is not available to everybody else. If you would like to check it, then you can go and do so. Some of what I may say in this lecture, and indeed in other lectures, may strike you as totally incredible. Some of it may also strike you as dubious, to say the least. If you feel that, well, go and check it. But what I'm going to do, I must admit, is to take a few short cuts, because having done a certain amount of the homework myself, I am not going to take too much time justifying every single claim that I make. And some of what I'm saying is, on the face of it, fairly audacious, though as far as I can see, readily justifiable. Now, the first and perhaps most obvious observation which I'm going to make is that human beings do not respond to other animals equally. Their response, shall we say, to tigers and lions and elephants is more dramatic and more easily characterised than their response to, shall we say, earthworms and slugs. This doesn't mean to say they don't know what earthworms and slugs are, but earthworms and slugs are less dramatic animals in human significance than elephants, lions or tigers. That doesn't come as a shock to any of you, but it's a point that ought to be made at the very beginning. Now, in terms of the more significant animals, what Roy Ellen would like to call the more salient animals, in terms of these animals, it is possible to recognise a remarkable and clear pattern, which I can lay out to you immediately without any further notice. First of all, people arrange animals into what can be called tiers. There are animals of the top level, animals of the sky. There are animals of the middle level, the level where we are living. And there are animals of the lower level, which is the level below human beings in the universe system. And that includes the animals that live in the waters, that live in the rivers, in the lakes, and in the seas and the oceans. Indeed, in a more refined scheme, which I won't deal with at this point, it is possible to recognise two groupings of the lower level, those that are associated with the waters and those associated with the land. Now, when we look at the animals which are above people, we find, first of all, that these are very well represented by the large, high-flying birds. Birds of the upper level, not so much sparrows and robins and wrens, which are rather low-flying birds and also small, but the big birds which fly very high, birds like eagles, vultures, cranes, storks, herons. These birds are very intimately associated with the above, with the sky. They also very often tend to link in to people's sense of supreme divine authority. I'll come back to that later. At the level where human beings live, the most important animals, bluntly speaking, are the big cats, by far the most important. Jaguars, leopards, lions, and tigers are hugely important. In every part of the world where human beings live with these animals are valued very, very highly. They have very powerful significance in human beings' lives. And let me mention briefly before I go any further that in many parts of the world, people claim that there are people who can turn themselves into other animals. And you find again and again that in areas where there are jaguars, people claim that there are people, particularly shamans, who can turn themselves into jaguars. When you live in various parts of tropical Africa, you find that there are people who can turn themselves into leopards or can turn themselves into lions. And at this point, predictably, by the time you get to India and to Southeast Asia, you find that there are people, some of them indeed shamans again, who can turn themselves into tigers. You get used to this kind of thing. People are very often able, we are told, to turn themselves into other animals, but they always regularly turn themselves into a particular small range of other animals. When we go to a lower level still, when we've moved down from the sky level to the human level, we then go down to the lowest level of all. The most important animals at this level are always various kinds of snakes. Snakes have tremendous power in people's feelings. They are among the most significant symbols in human experience. They have an extraordinary place in human values. And I'll say a bit more about snakes in a moment, but at the moment I want to get you involved in the basic pattern in which people everywhere, even people incidentally who live in big industrial cities, are fundamentally themselves involved. That is, it's important to realise what it is that people are doing, and apparently they're doing all over the place more or less the same thing. There is always this same patterning of animals which we find basically everywhere. I mean, there's no evidence I've ever been able to come across that there's any part of the modern world in which people do not use basically the same fundamental pattern of animal symbols. Now, you'll notice that I haven't had much to say about slugs or about earthworms, although these are extremely widespread animals found wherever there are people. Nevertheless, certainly, let me modify that slightly, found in most places where there are people, certainly well within the reach of human beings in most places. Nevertheless, although widely known and widely named, they are not part of animal symbols in any sort of very powerful sense. Now, a small digression at this point, which is not too much of a digression. I've mentioned that slugs and earthworms are extremely widely known to human beings, and indeed they're named in one human language after another. As you're probably well aware, all human languages have a remarkable vocabulary for animals. They also have remarkable vocabulary for plants, but we're concentrating on animals, that is, non-human animals, today. And these big vocabularies for dealing with animals have not yet, I regret, been fully or adequately studied, but there's not the slightest doubt that they are there, and that anyone who takes the trouble to enter into the animal vocabulary of a particular people will always find that they can build up big lists, and that in fact virtually always there is a word for earthworm, and there is a word for slug, and there is a word for snail, and so it goes on. But only a limited fraction of this huge vocabulary deals with salient animals, deals with tigers, deals with eagles, deals with snakes. That's a particular face of it which is rather more specialised, but again, just as universal as the big animal vocabularies. Now, having laid this out in a fairly straightforward sort of way, in a three-tier system, let me go on to say a bit more about this system. It can be elaborated quite considerably, and I don't need to go into all the detail today, because once you've got the hang of how it works, you can, as it were, develop it for yourself. You can look around and discover the finer print and the way in which it is applied in different parts of the world. But let me move beyond the general pattern now to give you some examples. Let's start in the Amazon basin in South America, where there are a very large number of different peoples speaking languages, some of which are unrelated to each other, but all of these peoples share what can be called a fundamentally similar culture. In the whole sweep from the Caribbean islands down to the upper branches of the Paraná and Paraguay rivers in South America, when the Europeans arrived, they found people who were pretty much the same throughout this huge area. And one of the characteristics of the similarities running through this area were the way in which they envisioned what I'm calling the three levels, or the three tiers. Above them were the eagles, and in particular in many areas, they place great emphasis upon the harpy eagle. At the middle level, where human beings live, were always the jaguars, tremendous feeling about jaguars in this area. And at the lowest level were the snakes, and the snake which particularly attracted their attention was the anaconda, an enormous water snake, constricting snake. Some of you perhaps have seen it in the wild. It's very impressive. It's true there were some parts of this area where there weren't actually any anacondas, but over a huge part of the area there are anacondas, and the Amerindian peoples knew about them. I won't go into the refinements of the system in South America, in the tropical Americas, but I will move fairly swiftly to sub-Saharan Africa, where the pattern was slightly different, but readily recognisable. In the upper layer, there was not the same emphasis upon the single species of eagle that you find very widespread in South America, but eagles and vultures, cranes and storks occupy a very important part in these people's values. And at the human layer, you find that the two key animals, again big cats, leopards in some areas, lions in others. In the wet forest areas of sub-Saharan Africa, there aren't any lions, and lions are therefore much less important than leopards. But in the areas of savanna, the extensive areas of drier country, which occupy so much of sub-Saharan Africa, what you find is that there are both lions and leopards as very significant animals. At the lowest level, without any surprises here, snakes are the most important animals, a very good variety of snakes in sub-Saharan Africa. But an interesting development, certainly in some substantial areas, that the snakes are subdivided in terms of values. The pythons are seen as having a different significance from the other snakes, pythons being much more auspicious, much nicer, much less frightening than the majority of snakes, towards which attitudes are often fairly negative. When we move even further afield, let's move eastwards to India. I'm not going to try and give you a complete world survey, but it's important to get some sense of the local examples and not just the general pattern. In India, again, we start at the top. India has an interesting refinement, which is unfamiliar when you've started in South America and in Africa, and that is that the key bird at the top level is not a species like the harpy in the forests of South America, nor is it a group of big high-flying birds as in Africa. It is a particular mythical form, Garuda. Garuda is the key bird of the upper levels, and this bird, as it were, takes into itself all the characteristics of the key birds of this level. Garuda, if you like, is a symbolic bird. It's a mythical bird. It's a symbolic bird in the same sense that the phoenix is a symbolic bird in Europe and in neighbouring areas around the Mediterranean. Nobody that I know of has actually seen a phoenix. It's a terribly important bird, but it's not usually put in the natural history books. It belongs in metaphysics rather than in physics. It belongs in the world of the spirit rather than in the world of the carnal, in the world of the flesh. And Garuda is rather like that too. Garuda is a bird which is beyond ordinary experience, a bird of the spirit world. And this is significant because, as I shall have to go on to say later on in this lecture, there is, of course, an important metaphysical component in all these animal symbols, which have such enormous significance. Within India, moving down, you don't have to be very well informed about animal symbols to realise, of course, that Indians have to use the tiger as a key animal in their world. Those of you who have read Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book will realise the importance that the tiger plays in the storytelling. And you'll also have realised the importance of the cobra in that storytelling. As one moves down the Indian system to the level below human, one comes, of course, inevitably to snakes. But in India, one particular species of snake dominates the imagery, dominates the imagination of Indian peoples. And Kipling picked that snake up in his Jungle Book. I suppose when you're very young and you read the Jungle Book, you have an intuitive sense of how enormously important and powerful this kind of storytelling is. It took me many decades to realise why the Jungle Book has the emotional impact that it has. I mean, fundamentally, Kipling, who was an Anglo-Indian, picked up the imagery and the myths of northern India, basically Hindi-speaking India, and he turned them into English language storytelling. But the process in which he's involved is deeply rooted in the values of the Indian peoples of whom he is basically writing. He is not really an innovator. He is a re-improviser, a storyteller. And the place of the cobra, the place of the snake, the place of Chil the kite, and the place of the wolf pack in those values are nothing that Kipling is inventing. It was there long before he was born. As you move into Southeast Asia from the subcontinent, the pattern does not change hugely. Again, you are dealing with some knowledge of Garuda in that area, but certainly you have to deal with the big flying birds above, with the tiger at the human level, and again with snakes lower down, and indeed there are cobras there too. Some of the test cases of animal symbolism come in those parts of the world which are not well provided with what you might call suitable imagery. What about the British Isles, for example, a place which I haven't mentioned at all in this lecture? What about the British Isles? There are all sorts of problems in the British Isles. There are no big cats. And in Ireland, there aren't even any snakes. So what do you do if you happen to be British or Irish? This is a very interesting question, and one which could actually take us off on a huge digression, which I do not want to do. But very briefly, when dealing with the British Isles, the way they deal with it is not to buck out of animal symbolism or to adopt totally crazy, unexpected animal symbolisms, but they deal with it basically by borrowing. If you look at the symbolism of the British Isles, you will find that it is not devoid of animals which actually don't live there at all. The United Kingdom has arms which are held up by two very important mythical animals, namely the lion and the unicorn. Where the unicorn comes from is a very big subject that I won't enter into, rather like Garuda in India. Nobody actually who lives in the British Isles has recently seen a unicorn. Our knowledge of the natural history of unicorns is not too good. Our knowledge of lions is a great deal better, but you won't find many in the British Isles outside the zoos, the wildlife parks, and other places where they've been imported. And indeed, what the British have done is to import the lion and the leopard as symbolic animals. A lion rampant occupies the royal standard of Scotland. Three leopards occupy the royal standard of England. All over the area where big cats are found, you find that big cats are associated with royalty and with authority. And the kings of England and of Scotland have borrowed this imagery of royalty from places further south, where the imagery was well established, presumably long before it was borrowed into the British Isles. The Irish, as I've said already, have a further symbolic problem, which they turn to advantage, not ignorant that there are such animals as snakes. The Irish know perfectly well that there are such animals as snakes, but they're not in Ireland. And this is not a minus, it is a plus, because it proves that Ireland is a holy country which has repelled snakes. Didn't Patrick himself expel the snakes from Ireland and re-establish and reinforce Ireland's identity as a holy island, a place where snakes cannot live? In this case, what's happening is that snakes, precisely because they're absent, are being brought into the symbolism, but their absence becomes positive. The Irish don't ignore the symbolism of snakes, but they fit snakes into the pattern in a way which is broadly borrowed, in the same way that lions and tigers have been borrowed in England and Scotland, and indeed lions have also been borrowed in Irish symbolism, but not in quite the same way. Now, in the same way, of course, there are other parts of the world which are also challenging to the universal animal system, though in slightly different directions. Let us look, for example, at the Pacific Islands, a very testing case, because in the Pacific Islands, as you're probably well aware, there is in fact a remarkable shortage of the familiar fauna of the Old World and of the New. In the Pacific Islands, the people encounter vast numbers of oceanic fishes, a very exciting range of shellfish, but on the whole a distinctly limited range of land fauna. And this has had some very remarkable effects upon the way in which the conventional animal imagery of these peoples has been inflected. Now, precisely what happened in the history of the Pacific Islands is a rather difficult question to answer, because people moved into those islands, presumed they did migrate into them from other areas outside the Pacific Basin, but in a period so prehistoric that we are very hard put to piece together quite how the process occurred, except in the broadest possible terms. But the consequences of being human and of having this fundamental patterning of the three levels geared to animals is very important to the Pacific Islanders. They don't, any more than the British Islanders, drop out of animal symbolism or animal layering just because they have got a distinct shortage of the right animals. Most of them don't have any eagles. None of them have got any big cats. And on a great many of the islands, there aren't even any snakes. Now, what do you do in that kind of situation? What is interesting is that we find that they all do something. They don't simply drop out of animal symbol layering of a kind familiar in monsoon Asia or in Africa. What they do is that they modify animal symbols in such a way as to be able broadly to fit in with everybody else. Now, I don't pretend to know how this process actually occurred, but it is fairly clear what the result is. Let's look at an area which we've already dealt with when looking at the process of reversal, and these are the Solomon Islands in the southwestern Pacific. In the Solomon Islands, there are no big cats. There's a shortage of large birds of prey, and there are at the same time snakes. There are actually sea snakes there, but there are also land snakes. In some parts of the Pacific, there are no land snakes at all. But in the Solomon Islands, what do we find? If we go to the island of San Cristobal, an island which I've mentioned already in the previous lecture on reversal, when we go to the island of San Cristobal, what we find is the basic pattern is there, but with some rather interesting twists and inflections. If we start at the bottom, well, there are land snakes, and the snakes occupy their conventional position within the system. So there's nothing too surprising about that. When we go to the top level, we do find a bit of a surprise in that the key bird of the Solomon Islanders is actually the frigate bird, which is a marine bird, very widespread in tropical seas. There are three species of frigate birds in the world. They have a very, very wide distribution between them and are typical of tropical islands. One sees frigate birds in all sorts of places, even when one is on the other side of the world from when one last saw them. For the Solomon Islanders, the frigate bird has come to occupy the niche occupied by eagle or by other big predatory bird in some other parts of the world. So a role which in the Andes of South America is occupied by the condor, which in the Amazonian basin is occupied by the harpy eagle, in the Solomon Islands is occupied by frigate bird. Frigate bird enters vividly into the carving and the other art of the Solomon Islanders. But the biggest surprise of all in the Solomon Islands comes at the middle level. I said already there are no big cats. Indeed, there's a very substantial shortage of large mammals whatsoever. Of course, there are human beings who are migrants and who doubtless arrived in the islands by boat. And there are also pigs, large domestic animals, which, as far as we know, were brought by people. But when one is familiar with the fauna of monsoon Asia, fairly nearby, and with the fauna of tropical Africa, further afield across the Indian Ocean, the Solomon Islands come across as a very poor place indeed for large mammals. And the place of the tiger, of the lion, of the leopard in this system is taken by sharks. This isn't the only part of the Pacific where this is so, but it's a good example. Now, your immediate reaction to this may be that this is purely fanciful, that sharks cannot possibly take the place of tigers or of lions in a system of animal symbols, even though Europeans refer to sharks, as they do, as the tigers of the sea. This, you will say, is purely metaphorical, and that the local people cannot possibly believe that sharks are suitable as occupants of the middle human level. But I suppose the crunch is this, that when you look around in the Solomon Islands and ask, which animals in this system do the Solomon Islanders use when they want to talk about people turning themselves into other animals? Remember, we've talked about shamans turning themselves into jaguars in South America. We have seen people turning themselves into leopards in the wet forests of tropical Africa. Which is the animal in the restricted, but nevertheless not totally poor, fauna of the Solomon Islands into which people change themselves? Now, anyone who knows the Solomon Islands knows the answer to that question instantly. Here, as in some other parts of the tropical Pacific, people are said to turn themselves into sharks. There are people who claim to have a special affinity, a special relationship with sharks. Sharks are the animals to which people's imagery is constantly returning. Sharks are somehow the most human of the non-human animals of the Solomons, and indeed elsewhere. And therefore, of course, that claim that these tigers of the sea really are symbolically the tigers of the Solomon Islanders is not fanciful. It's not just a play on words. There is very substantial evidence that the Solomon Islanders are using the sharks as animals which fill the human level role within the system which they probably brought with them when their ancestors first arrived in this group of islands from wherever it was, the islands of Southeast Asia or wherever. But although I don't want to have any sort of speculation about what exactly happened in the first place, the actual pattern seems to be very well established indeed. Now, there are refinements in this system, which I don't want to go into in a brief lecture, but I can give you some indication of some of the other things which happen within an animal system. I've mentioned already, when talking about witchcraft, the imagery of the Rangi people who live in the centre of the East African plateau in what is now Tanzania. And among the Rangi, I discovered that there is a quite substantial refinement of the animal symbol system, because they bring into play a distinction between animals of the night and animals of the day. So that, for example, they distinguish between pythons among snakes, which are auspicious animals, and the other snakes, not just poisonous snakes, but also small non-poisonous snakes. All the other snakes are inauspicious and are associated with the night. In the same way, as one goes up the system, lions and leopards are basically auspicious, but hyenas, which I've mentioned already, hyenas are deeply inauspicious and are associated with the night. And as you go up the system further, the tawny eagles of the area and the vultures are auspicious, but the big eagle owls, which come out at night and which hoot and which forebode death, these are very inauspicious. Owls, incidentally, are very significant animals, as you probably know, in all parts of the world. People's attitudes towards owls are very powerful and very double-edged in all areas. Owls are animals which people have very strong feelings about. Now, animal symbolism is not exhausted there. There are yet other animals which can be brought into the system, but which don't fit so tidily into the various levels. And one particular group of animals which I want to talk about are the animals which play the role of the trickster. These animals have got certain features in common. They are not as compact a group as, shall we say, the big cats, which I've been talking about up to now. But they do, as we shall see in a moment, have quite a lot in common. Let us look, first of all, at who the trickster is, and then let us look at the kind of animals which play the trickster role. Now, for Europeans, there are two animals which are particularly familiar in the trickster role. The trickster, let me say first of all, is a character who is found in storytelling in one part of the world after another, and his basic characteristic is that he, and apparently the trickster is always male and not female, but he is somebody who is basically amoral. He is constantly trying to take advantage of other players in the stories, and in the process he is sometimes successful, but he's often out-tricked and even killed at his own game. The name trickster was actually coined in the context of Anglo-America by American specialists on Amerindian peoples, among whom the trickster is a very, very prominent figure in the storytelling coast to coast. And in North America, indeed, a very remarkable hybrid trickster came into existence, which brings me back to my point about those tricksters who are familiar to Europeans. On the cotton plantations of the Old South, there seems to have been a meeting of three main traditions of trickster stories. Some of those trickster stories came from Europe. They came with the European colonists across the Atlantic. Some of those trickster stories came from West Africa with the slaves who were forcibly deported across the Atlantic from their homes on the African side. And some of those stories came from the Amerindian peoples who lived in that southeastern corner of North America. The ingredients that went into the story are difficult, if not impossible, now to reconstruct in detail, though one can make some quite sensible guesses at what they probably were. But the outcome of the story was the character whom we now call Brer Rabbit. Brer Rabbit is a product of the southern plantations. He is a distinctive character. He has his own place in storytelling. But it's also clear that he has an ancestry. Brer Rabbit did not come from nowhere. He came from the Amerindian peoples, whose trickster was the great hare, a lagomorph animal, a rabbit-like animal. He came probably from similar stories about lagomorph animals, hares, brought from West Africa by the slaves. And the slaves may also have brought with them, though we can't be sure about this, stories of other kinds of tricksters too. Certainly, slightly further south in the Caribbean, on the island of Jamaica, there are trickster stories about a character called Anansi, who is a spider, and it is pretty certain that those spider trickster stories were brought from some part of the tropical African coast across the Atlantic with the slaves. Brer Rabbit's principal antagonist in the plantation stories is, as you all know, Brer Fox. And Brer Fox was doubtless brought across the Atlantic by the Europeans, because in Europe, of course, the supreme trickster is the Red Fox. Interestingly enough, in North America, though the Red Fox lives there, the Amerindian peoples don't seem ever to have used the Red Fox as a trickster, though over huge areas of North America, the greater part of North America indeed, they used a very, very similar animal as the trickster, and this animal, as again you probably all know, is coyote. Trickster stories in North America are dominated by coyote, but not, as it happens, among the Amerindian peoples of the southeast in the woodlands there, where the cotton plantations were established and where Brer Rabbit came into existence. Once you have begun to hear trickster stories, you will recognise trickster stories anywhere in the world. Basically, trickster stories are always much the same, and stories about Brer Rabbit can be recognised even when they're not stories about Brer Rabbit. They may be stories about Monsieur Renard, the fox, in Europe. They may be stories about mouse deer in India and in Southeast Asia. They may be stories about raven on the northwest coast of North America, or indeed right round the curve of the North Pacific into the east of Siberia. But trickster is always much the same, and the range of tricksters is not huge. Certain key animals, some of which have already become quite prominent, animals which are rabbit-like, hares, and the relatives of hares are very important in this context. Very important too are small canids, members of the dog family, never apparently the largest members of the dog family, the wolves, never apparently the hunting dogs, but the smaller members of the dog family, foxes and notoriously coyote in North America, these animals are very, very intimately twined into the trickster role. I mentioned briefly Mouse Deer in tropical Asia, Mouse Deer in the Indian subcontinent and in Southeast Asia. This is a small, nippy animal. It doesn't look like a rabbit or a hare, but it is a small, fast and rather furtive animal. It looks a bit like a small antelope, though technically, in terms of systematic natural history, it isn't. It's a member of its own rather small family. But what is fascinating from the point of view of somebody who's interested in both natural history and also in storytelling is that in the only other part of the world where animals of the mouse deer group, mouse deer family, the Tragulidae, are found, and that is in the wet forests of tropical Africa, where there are some very similar small animals, you find, well, that these animals too are tricksters, that wherever animals of this type occur, the people who live there recognise them as tricksters, and indeed in some other parts of Africa, people recognise the dik-diks and other small antelopes, which belong to a quite different family from the mouse deer, but very closely resemble them in appearance. You find that they too are regarded as tricksters. Very famous, principally now because of the transport of the slaves to the West Indies, are the spider tricksters of the wet forest areas of tropical Africa, which are pretty certainly, as I've indicated briefly, the origin, the original form of the trickster stories now of Jamaica. Now, without trying to eliminate all possible references to tricksters in every direction, without trying to find every different kind of trickster that exists in the world, it is possible to say that tricksters are characterised by certain characteristics, whatever form they take. It's worth throwing in, for the sake of reference, the tortoise tricksters, which one finds in parts of West Africa. And it's worth remembering, of course, that tortoise turns up as a trickster, defeating hare in stories from classical Greece. But one of the things you notice about all these animals, spiders, tortoises, mouse deer, small antelopes, the small canids, the lagomorph animals, the hares and the rabbits, one notices that none of them are very big, and that all of them have a capacity for rapidly hiding themselves. The tortoise is a bit strange in this respect, but of course the tortoise has one very unusual characteristic. Without actually being able to move very fast, it can very fast withdraw its head, its limbs and its tail from danger. And it's fairly clear that trickster sort of animals are fitting to trickster sort of stories. Trickster animals are small. They rely upon what the English would call brain rather than brawn. They are nippy. They are able to get out of trouble quickly. And it seems that wherever across the world people have looked for tricksters, for animals to play the parts in the stories, they have found always, more or less, the same sorts of animals to do it, sometimes to a quite remarkable degree of similarity. Now, there are all sorts of problems about this. In the first place, I don't pretend to know how animal stories came into existence. I don't know how the Solomon Islanders turned to sharks. I don't know the precise story of how Brer Rabbit came into existence. But it is fairly clear that we're dealing here with a thoroughly coherent pattern of basic correlations. This is something we cannot ignore. It is quite clear that human beings everywhere are working in very similar ways, and that when the slave owners, the slaves, and the Indians who welcomed the escaping slaves into their villages in the southeast of North America told stories, they basically, whatever the differences of their background, were telling the same stories. Very striking, that. Now, it's possible, as you can gather by now, I'm sure, that once somebody who is interested in animal symbols and in animal stories gets into a lecture of this kind, they can go on and on and on and on. There is a practical limit, believe it or not, to what could be said on this subject, but I'm not going to try and reach that limit today, you'll all be pleased to hear. But at the very end of this lecture, let me make a few very general comments about what is the significance of all this. I mean, yes, it's all very interesting and remarkable that these animals have similar significances in different parts of the world. But what is the significance of those significances? And I ought to say that at this point we come to the edge of human knowledge. I mean, really, we don't know entirely how human beings work. There's a huge amount we don't understand about the workings of human beings. Clearly, you can all see from what I've said today that something very significant is happening here. We are coming across universal patterns of meaning in human experience, in human feelings. But at the same time, if you ask, how does this fit into the whole business of cognitive patterns, into the whole business of the patterning of human knowledge? Let me give some very simple observations about what is being said here by people. How are people using animals in this way? Very simply, it is clear that people see animals as windows into the other world. Animals are being used as visible, tangible, audible introductions to the world of the spirit, to the other side. That we may have great difficulty in talking to the gods. We may have great difficulty praying to God Almighty. We may not be prophets, and we may not ourselves receive messages from the other side, though apparently some people do. But at the same time, lay people, and uninitiated though we are, we do have an entree to the other world. It is the animals. That the animals provide us with doorways or pigeonholes, if one dare use that expression, into the world of the other side. It is the way in which these other animals behave, the way in which they resemble, but also the way in which they differ from human beings, which gives us a sense not only of the difference between us and the animals, between us and the superhuman powers, but also a sense of a continuum in which we can, in various ways, make contact with the other side. That's a general observation, a further example, and that is that there's a special relationship between people and birds. I expect you are all aware of that. This is probably one reason why bird watching is such a popular pursuit among the fundamentally, emotionally and symbolically starved peoples of the industrial countries. Bird watching is a kind of hunting, but it's also a spiritual pursuit. Birds are very special, they can fly, they give people a very particular sense of freedom. And in many parts of the world, birds are used for divination. A very fine example of this, of course, is found in Borneo and in Sulawesi, in the islands of Southeast Asia, where there is an elaborate process of reading messages from the spirit world by way of birds. Even in the much more mundane world of the British Isles, you all know the augury, the bird imagery, which is based upon magpies. One for sorrow, two for joy, three for a girl and four for a boy, and so on. And even among the sort of the rather spiritually and symbolically low-key English, there is in fact some sign of this animal imagery, even of bird augury. I could go on, I'm not going to. What I want to do is to turn my attention at this point to the next kind of encounter which we have to deal with. We've dealt with encounters with the various kinds of superhuman powers. We've mentioned briefly the encounters with plants. There are the encounters with non-human animals. We now need to look at particular kinds of critical encounters occurring among human beings themselves. We encounter other human beings. And in particular, I want to turn to the ambiguous and disturbing world of relations between members of the same community, between the three main subgroups that live in any human community, the children, the women, and the men. And I'll deal with that in the next lecture of the series.